Captain Timothy Plummer, on loan from British Petroleum to manage Alyeska's new project in Valdez, says his team should now be able to do just that if a spill should occur. They've been training for a little more than 2 weeks.
We've gone through some very intensive training with the people, and, you know, once the vessel's arrived and get the final equipment fitted to it and the people ready to do it, and it's like any preparational program, we're ready to go to work.
The system includes three ships called escort response vessels, specially outfitted with booms and skimmers, plus another equipped with a weir boom. At least one of them will accompany all loaded tankers. A tug barge capable of holding 140,000 barrels of oil will be based at Naked Island in the middle of Prince William Sound. Other barges will be equipped with booms to contain a spill. And Plummer says that's not all.
We'll also have a control center with a dispatcher on 24 hours a day who will communicate with the escort vessels. And we have a base in Valdez which we'll operate from. And we have a six-person staff, 24 hours a day here to support the operation of these vessels, to support the operation of the base, and to, you know, help stage any response equipment from here that would be necessary.
The escort vessels are under contract for a year, and even though they're all American ships and have American crews, they've come from all over the world.
One of the vessels came over from Singapore, and there was a couple from down in the Gulf of Mexico, and there was one on the West Coast and one down in South America.
The Soviet super skimmer Vita Gubsky is the one foreign vessel on duty for Alyeska in Prince William Sound. It will stay there until another vessel arrives from the Gulf of Mexico to replace it. Alyeska has extended the Vita Gubsky's contract until the end of July with two more 15-day options. The costs of the new program will become a part of the operating expenses of the Alyeska pipeline, shared by the seven oil company owners. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
Fish and Wildlife has been studying the eagles in Prince William Sound for years. They report that 54 of 111 active nests have been abandoned this year. In the remaining nests, there are fewer chicks than in previous years. In areas heavily affected by oil, no young were observed. The lightly affected Montague Island area showed 10 of 16 nests active. Nearly a third of the eagles found in the total survey area were in those 10 nests. Despite these figures, Fish and Wildlife's Robert Mesta doesn't think this year's production drop is necessarily devastating.
I think what you're looking at is probably, you know, one bad year of production and then probably a slow climb to the previous production efforts before the oil spill.
He adds, however, that the ultimate effects of the spill on eagles won't be known for years. In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.
Gee, if I was a law school professor, this is a great question to ask the final graduating class in their exam, you know. Here, just take these facts and just, you know, it would... I've never seen a case that presented as many issues, really, and some substantive issues as this one does.
Hundreds of Upper Cook Inlet drift fishermen will be having a very long 4th of July weekend pacing the docks. The Department of Fish and Game canceled Friday and Monday's regular fishing periods. Regional Fish and Game Supervisor Ken Florey says boats working at test fishery all this week have been finding considerable amounts of gooey brown tar balls up and down the tide rips.
This time it does not appear to be getting any better. And nor does it appear to really be getting any worse. But at this point, there is still too much oil in the inlet to really have what we would consider a safe fishery. We're not going to go out there and be cavalier at all with the fishery. We're not going to fish unless we have an area that we feel very confident that it's clean and that we can conduct an orderly fishery.
Florey says the tar balls are concentrated in the southern part of the district, and that's where most of the fish are right now. As the season progresses and the salmon move further north, he says there's a good chance they can pull off a fishery. Earlier this week, biologists got back the results of a lab analysis of a tar ball found in the inlet last week. It turned out not to be from the Exxon Valdez. It was refined bunker crude oil. But six other samples turned in later tested positive for the Exxon Valdez, and state officials say there's no question that the majority of the oil in the inlet is Exxon's. While the drift fleet remains in port, the prospects for fishing look much brighter for the more than 400 set netters on the east side of Cook Inlet. That fishery is slated for its first opening on Monday. So far, daily test fishing off the beaches has turned up no oil. Reporting from Homer, I'm Eileen Hughes.
Kodiak is the last spill-affected community to come under the lowered rates. Exxon officials say in Prince William Sound, only a small number of vessel owners chose not to go with the new contracts, and cleanup continued unhindered. That's not the case in Kodiak. Upset boat owners are reluctant to accept the rates, which are estimated to be 25 to 50% lower than in the original contract. A large vessel making $4,000 a day would go down to about $2,000 a day. Boat owners say they can't keep crew members at lowered wages. But the biggest gripe has to do with the fact fishermen were not consulted when Exxon drew up the new contracts. Boat owner Louis Lowenberg says Exxon did tell the fleet the contracts were going to be renegotiated, but fishermen were also told they'd have a voice in the matter.
We negotiate every day with cannery. Sometimes we come out, sometimes they come out. But whatever we negotiate, we stick by. Changing horses in the middle of the stream doesn't sit well with anybody, number one. Number two, there were no negotiations. And number three, a lot of people in this community still feel this is an emergency situation until such time that we can return to a normal way of life.
At Wednesday's oil spill meeting, Exxon's operations superintendent, Bill Rainey, started to explain Exxon's reasons for scaling down contracts. But the audience found those reasons unacceptable.
Every person that I've met that I believe to be reasonable feels that the current contract rates are exorbitantly high. They were instituted as emergency rates from the day of the spill. That's been going on for 3 months now. As John Peavy said, we have a responsibility to our stockholders to be fiscally responsible. That's the process that we're instituting now. There are different concepts of fairness. We cannot make everybody happy, and we will not make everybody happy. But we have to be fair to the other boat owners whose contracts have already been negotiated. This whole area operates as a network. You know it does, and I know it does. If we're changing what we believe to be fair, it is our company's money.
And you want to keep your stockholders happy, right?
Our stockholders are those.
But when Exxon came into this thing, they said, no matter what the costs are, we will stay until it cleaned up. Now, all of a sudden, they're worried about the cost. Now, what's going on?
We think the current costs are unfair.
We think the oil still is under
the oil. That's right.
We want it clean.
Though other communities accepted the lower rates, vessel owner Dave Harville says that doesn't mean Kodiak has to.
He just said we're a network. We ain't no network. This is Kodiak. We've got less boats doing more work than any other place on this oil spill. You go count your boats in the Sound, and you ask how many of those boats have got guts enough to go out and shell across straits any time of the year and put their lives on the line. We got the toughest little piece of stretch of water in the entire world. I've seen it go from 0 to 60 knots. In less than 5 minutes, in the middle of Shelikoff Straits. These guys you've got out there are professionals. They are bred into this fishery. They're bred into this. They understand this fishery. They understand this island. They understand the waters around here. And we're the only people who do. And I guess we are a little egoistic. I guess we do feel we may be worth negotiating on our own.
The boat owners say Exxon will have a serious safety problem if the entire fleet walks off the job and new crews, unfamiliar with these waters, have to be brought in from outside. Not to mention the fact cleanup would come to a standstill while a new fleet is installed. The federal on-scene coordinator for cleanup, Rear Admiral Keim, was asked how the Coast Guard views the situation.
This is something I think that we're not going to insert ourselves into. That's no place. This is a collective bargaining type of operation. I think traditionally the government stays out of that. I think they should stay out of that. I think that's one of the strengths of our society. We will monitor the situation. We certainly would be concerned if this results in a slowdown of the cleanup effort, as I would. And therefore, I think we request very respectfully that both Exxon and the fishing vessel owners negotiate in a proper way, and that neither group hold the environment nor the innocent people who don't fall into those two categories hostage to this type of negotiation.
It's uncertain whether the 150 vessels working cleanup will all quit. Dave Harville says they plan to put it to a vote. Meanwhile, Exxon has agreed to a meeting with fishing representatives. But Exxon officials say, though they're willing to talk about how the new contracts will be implemented, the rates stand firm. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Steve Provant is heading the oil spill effort for the Department of Environmental Conservation out of Valdez. He testified Tuesday before the Oil Spill Commission.
Our studies and the information that we're collecting is all going to be through chain of custody, through legal means, so that we can use that information in the courts if we have to.
Litigation appears to be the driving force behind oil spill-related research, and because of the legal ramifications, individuals have been cautioned about publicly discussing their work. "I can't talk about that," or "I've already said more than I should," are frequent answers to questions. Craig O'Connor is a lawyer working for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says the research is being conducted preparatory to litigation. He says they don't want to jeopardize the case of the United States in that regard. In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.
It is our company's money. And you want to get your stockholders happy, right? Our stockholders are
those. But when Exxon came into this thing, they said, no matter what the costs are, we will stay until it cleaned up. Now all of a sudden they're worried about the cost. Now what's going on?
We think the current costs are on fire.
We think the oil still is under the oil.
That's right.
We
want to clean.
Attorney General Douglas Bailey says state attorneys will be in court as early as Wednesday seeking permission to open a probe into the loss of the spill documents. Right now, all formal fact-finding or discovery is on hold pending court approval. But Bailey doesn't want to have to rely on stale memories to reconstruct this incident. The New York Times broke the story of the erased Exxon computer tapes in its Sunday editions after a former Exxon computer technician told the paper he'd been unjustly fired over the loss of the tapes. 33-year-old Kenneth Davis told The Times that somebody put the spill tapes on a rack normally used for recycling old computer tapes, where new information was recorded on them, erasing the spill data. All documents relating to the spill must be preserved by court order. Exxon spokesperson Les Rogers told the paper that other copies of the documents may exist somewhere, but that the company had made no search for other copies. The tapes contain internal corporate communications from Exxon Shipping Company and Exxon USA. Bailey says the destruction of those tapes could prove to be crucial.
Peter, there's no question about the fact that it could be of tremendous significance and tremendous adverse impact on the interests of the state of Alaska in pursuing remedies against Exxon. Without knowing a little bit more about the actual documents, I can't tell you that it is for sure, but if the content of the documents, if the subject matters of the documents destroyed are as reported in the press, then it is a significant blow to our proceeding successfully.
Bailey says the time period covered by those tapes, a little more than a month after the Exxon Valdez grounded in Prince William Sound, could coincide with the time Exxon officials were focusing on how they would portray the controversial initial cleanup efforts to the public. The state and Exxon have already battled in the media over the cleanup, especially with regard to the use of chemical dispersants on the spill. And Bailey says internal corporate memos and other communications may shed important light on what the state has called Exxon's slanted version of its efforts. Davis, the fired Exxon computer technician, told the Times that he was made a scapegoat by Exxon, but he said he had no reason to believe anyone at the company wanted those records destroyed. Bailey says the erasure may well have been accidental, but he adds that if someone at Exxon had wanted those tapes destroyed in deliberate violation of a court order, this would be one way of going about it.
Well, certainly if I was, I think that if somebody was trying to cover something up, they would certainly look at a way to conceal the fact that it was done intentionally. Obviously, one of those avenues would be to make it appear that it was done accidentally.
State Attorney General Douglas Bailey. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
The newest spills in Prince William Sound were in the southwest area, where heavy cleanup is still underway from the Exxon Valdez disaster. One of these new spills was the responsibility of the Navy. The other was purportedly caused by a vessel contracted by Exxon. Coast Guard Petty Officer Brad Terrell says the most recent spill was caused last Wednesday night about 9 p.m. during deballasting operations of the naval ship Mount Vernon, which was located in Lower Passage.
Estimated 750 to 1,000 gallons of number 2 fuel oil, which is diesel, leaked into their ballast tank, and it got pumped out with the water.
Terrell says deballasting operations were shut down immediately when the leak was discovered, and the tanks affected were emptied. Terrell also says that cleanup was immediate.
The Navy immediately took care of the problem, deploying three of their skimmers, and also had help from one civilian skimmer nearby. And there were also a couple of fishing vessels with absorbent pads and booms that had been operating in the area on the Valdez spill.
As of Friday afternoon, the Coast Guard's Marine Safety Office announced the naval spill as all cleaned up, except for a slight sheen on the water, which the sun is expected to evaporate. Although cleanup was said to be quick, the Coast Guard's knowledge of the spill was delayed because reporting of the incident went through naval channels.
This happened Wednesday night around 9 p.m. and was reported to the Navy, apparently in Washington State, and Washington State referred to the Coast Guard. That's how we found out about it.
The other spill the Coast Guard learned of Friday happened almost 2 weeks ago. Terrell says the skipper of the boat reported to the Coast Guard that 10 days before, on June 20th, the landing craft he was piloting hit a rock south of Knight Island in Mummy Bay.
He said that that the vessel was beached and began leaking fuel oil, and the amount was unknown, but when we conducted the overflight after finding out about it, it had all been cleaned up in that area.
Despite the fact that oil no longer remains in Mummy Bay, Terrell says the Coast Guard will research the spill due to the delay in reporting.
The Coast Guard has launched an investigation on this incident because it wasn't reported to us at the time that the spill began. And the boat is apparently a contract vessel contracted by Exxon. And when the investigation is complete and we have that information, we will release it.
Coast Guard Petty Officer Brad Terrell. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
It was another ship and another grounding that caused an oil spill near Palmer Station, Antarctica. At the height of last winter, January 28th, the Bahia Paraiso was carrying provisions to an Argentinian research station and about 300 tourists on a cruise. The boat made a sightseeing stop at the American research outpost at Palmer Station. Polly Penhale is a researcher for the National Science Foundation.
When it left, it went out at a 10 to 15 knots and ran right into a pinnacle. And it ripped a hole in the keel, I mean in the hull. The ship was constructed with a passage midships that was about, I guess, a meter squared, and water immediately went through the ship into the engine room, and the electricity went off the ship, which made it difficult to evacuate people because the lifeboats couldn't be lowered.
The tourists, most of whom were elderly, were all successfully evacuated in rubber rafts and towed back to the Palmer Station in inflatable Zodiacs. The station has only 40 beds and not much to occupy 300 tourists, who then watched the Bahia Paraiso sink and leak petroleum products into the water. Within a day, the station personnel had developed a cleanup plan for the spill, which was mostly diesel fuel. But with no booms or skimmers, it would be several days waiting before the equipment was flown to Chile and shipped to Palmer Station. By the fourth day, 10 square miles were covered with the oil slick. An estimated 200,000 gallons of oil spilled, a small slick when compared to the 10 million gallons of crude spilled from the Exxon Valdez. Penhale says the area was lucky that the spill was small and that it was mostly diesel, but the delay made matters worse.
The team got down about 15 days after the spill, and by that time, with this volatile fuel, much of it had evaporated, much of it had apparently been mixed in the water column and been blown out away from the area. It wasn't the type of oil that you could clean up.
The Bahia Paraiso is still in the water, lying on its side, and is still slowly leaking fuel. It is now winter in the Antarctic, and the ship will probably be crushed in the shifting ice next spring. There are a lot of comparisons between the Bahia Paraiso spill and the one from the Exxon Valdez. William Fraser, a bird specialist who worked at Palmer Station, says oily penguins began showing up immediately. Seabirds were attracted to the shrimp and krill killed by the oil, and they in turn would be poisoned, just like in Alaska. And eventually, although it was not as strong as in Alaska, people began to respond emotionally.
And the Antarctica is sort of the last area in the world where you would expect a spill to occur. And from that standpoint, I'm beginning to sense that people are a little bit more aware. They're a little bit disappointed and a little bit angry that this we've sort of violated the last pristine environment left on the planet.
Scientists in Alaska are working with and around the emotional response to the Exxon Valdez spill as well. But what both groups want most is a better understanding of how cold water oil spills affect the environment. Ted Cooney of the Institute of Marine Science in Fairbanks says most people have the idea that oil spills might be more dangerous at high latitudes because the cold slows down any natural breakup process, as well as man-made attempts to clean up the spill.
Scientific questions that we'll hope to answer by looking at these two spills and seeing what does in fact happen is whether that's true or not, whether everything goes more slowly or whether some other compensating mechanisms come into play and somehow speed things up.
David Shaw of the Institute of Marine Science says there are samples from both spill areas that haven't even been looked at yet. There is still so much unknown about both oil spills, but comparing notes with the Antarctic scientists helps, and it will probably go on for a while.
So we can get back together some months from now and say, well, this is what we found, and how does that compare to what you found?
Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin.
That Ivory, a four-week-old harbor seal, she's one of six baby seals brought to Valdez covered in oil from the Exxon Valdez. Caring for the pups is a full-time job. Leslie McBain is one of the people working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week with the seals. She says they eat five times each day.
They're fed on a diet of herrings, and actually have one that's still on what we call a milkshake, and that's basically a complete formula that has all the vitamins that they need. And the restaurant herring, the biggest guy gets about 4.5 pounds per day.
The seals are almost unbearably cute, with enormous brown eyes, sleek spotted pelt, long claws, and sharp little teeth. The pups were originally fed through stomach tubes. As they progressed to a solid diet, it was first necessary to force the herring down their throats. McBain says they don't like the taste all that much to start out with.
You get your fingers in there once in a while. They don't really intentionally try and bite you, but occasionally a finger slips in there between those needle teeth and gets a little bite on it.
The harbor seals at the Valdez Center are thriving, getting fat and sassy, as McBain puts it. They've come a long way in the 3 weeks they've been here.
A few of these guys were caught near Herring Bay. They were all really heavily oiled, and I believe there are a few of them that were actually abandoned by their mothers. So we just had some catch boats out there. This was before the ban was put on, so they couldn't catch them anymore.
The decision not to catch any more of the seals was a controversial one, but in retrospect, NOAA biologist Bud Antonella still feels that it was the right call.
We felt, and I think it was based on good information, that they would probably have a better chance with their mothers than they would in captivity. Again, you have to recall, seals are not like otters, and because of that fat layer, they were able to thermoregulate properly and not lose an excess body heat to the external environment.
Antonellis has been monitoring Prince William Sound marine mammal population since the first days of the spill. NOAA has been working with the State Department of Fish and Game, conducting surveys by plane and boat, monitoring the behavior of animals as they come in contact with oil, the frequency of oiling, and the percentage of animals oiled. Previous research on seals is also being incorporated.
There was one study done with ring seals, and individual researcher actually placed seals in a pool of crude oil, and they were in there for an extended period of time, maybe three days, something like that. Then he removed the seals, and within 48 hours after removing the seals from that water, placing them in clean water, there was very little oil left on the pellets.
Although they have some understanding of the short-term effects of oil on seals, little is known of the long-term effects. Antonella says Prince William Sound has an historic population of some 4,000 to 5,000 harbor seals. To help understand how oiling affects the animals over the long haul, NOAA and Fish and Game have a permit to take 30 of those animals for necropsy purposes.
In the future, if such a disaster should ever happen again, we may choose different mitigating measures to protect them. In other words, even though we feel that our decision is best to leave the seals as they are in some of these oiled areas, we may decide in the future that disturbance and the cleanup activity may be better for the seals. In other words, the cleanup activity on the beaches of their haulouts. It may be better for the beaches to be cleaned up than it would be to let them continually use that area and be exposed to the oil over a long period of time. So it has very, very important management implications. And the only way we can collect that information is by sacrificing.
The results of the research are not being made public. Like so much of the science being conducted in Prince William Sound these days, harbor seal research data could eventually find its way into court as evidence of damage from the Exxon Valdez spill. In the meantime, Ivory, Ebony, Hercules, and their cohorts are flourishing on herring and cod liver oil. The current plan is to release the seals near Homer. Before releasing, they'll be tested for domestic diseases and then quarantined. Leslie McBain is confident about their chances of returning to the wild. She says a lot of it, like chasing down dinner, is a matter of instinct.
If we were to throw a fish in the pool with these guys, they'd chew it up a little bit, just experimenting with it. It is instinctive for them to chase anything. So they learn pretty much on their own. If you look at Hercules there, he's chasing his hind flippers, too.
In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.
Let me tell you something about these fishermen. They're not so unidirectional as people may make them out. I like to think of fishermen as practical environmentalists, okay? There's a lot of people that love otters because they're cute and cuddly. Basically, they see otter image, and they don't understand otter substance.
Denny DeGross, director of the Alaska Native Health Board, says that for natives, the disaster is especially painful because they've lived here for thousands of years.
It's like losing a friend. There's a tremendous sense of loss. It's like losing a family member when something like this happens to your home, to your land. It's a devastating experience.
DeGross says the secondary impact of dealing with a spill has been greater than the oil spill itself. Villagers are leaving home to work for Exxon, and communities are left only with elders and children. Child care workers aren't available, and elders have been forced to take over the parenting. Leonard Hamilton is director of health and social services for one of the agencies dealing with the communities. He points out that for some natives, having large amounts of ready cash makes it easier to buy alcohol. The sense of despair of the disastrous oil spill has contributed to recent suicides, he says. Hamilton adds that villagers are also concerned about the safety of eating the fish from the oil spill region. Exxon is sending in food to replace the fish that natives traditionally eat, but he says that that's not a healthy solution to the problem.
We have a long-term concern about the change in diet. The people of our region have recently been identified as extremely high risk for diabetes, and the dietary change, I think, can, especially with the types of foods that are going in, puts our people further at risk.
Native villages in southeast Alaska have begun sending traditional food to feed village members. In Anchorage, I'm Barbara Wish.
The notice of violation sent to Exxon from DEC is for failure to place containment around barge washing operations at Ingot Island on the morning of July 1st, which allowed oil to be washed from the shoreline into the waters of Upper Passage, just north of Knight Island in Prince William Sound. The accompanying letter from DEC on-scene coordinator Steve Provan states that no containment boom, sorbent boom, or skimming equipment was in place during the washing operation, and that a significant amount of oil and sheen was escaping. Provan's letter goes on to say, "This is an illegal and unacceptable situation and must be prevented at all beach cleaning sites." The notice, hand-delivered on July 2nd, requested that Exxon immediately place containment booms around all beach washing operations to prevent any further discharge of oil into state waters. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
And it seems to me if Exxon can't protect its records in its own secure buildings, then we may have to ask that some third party take possession of them. That's a possibility. I'm not suggesting that will happen. But if Exxon continues to demonstrate that they can't comply with the order, then obviously we'll have to find, at least seek, some other remedy.
Dr. Jerry Neff is a scientist working under contract to Exxon.
There were some anecdotal reports that oil was being found in some of the sheltered bays that had been heavily oiled and subsequently cleaned. And so we were asked by Exxon to go and sample sediments in those bays, places like Northwest Bay and Herring Bay.
Neff emphasizes the preliminary nature of the studies, but says there is some evidence of oil in sediments as deep as 125 feet below the ocean surface.
In terms of the work in the sheltered bays and so forth, where reports of oil had been received, our initial analyses don't show much oil, but we have been able to observe visually occasionally small tar balls and the sediment that put in a pan and shaken develops an oil slick and so forth. So there appears to be some oil in these sediments. So
scientists are encountering a number of problems with the sediment project. Neff says the seafloor is often rocky. He expects oil would concentrate in the finer sediments, sand and even clay, as it doesn't cling to rocks underwater. To improve data quality, they've begun using divers who can collect the finer fraction from between the rocks. Additionally, getting samples out of the water without being contaminated by oil sheens on the surface has caused some problems. Nevertheless, they are persisting and succeeding to some extent. In addition to sampling within heavily oiled bays, Neff says sediments are being collected further offshore as well.
In the offshore sediments, we were finding in some coastal areas that were oiled shortly after the spill. Around Knight Island and so forth, we are seeing a small amount of petroleum in the sediments.
Labs are analyzing the samples to determine the percentage of petroleum hydrocarbons present in the sediments. Neff says they're also trying to determine the chemical composition of any oil they find. The purpose is twofold: to establish what changes in toxicity may have occurred as the oil metamorphoses through time, and to find out if the oil is, in fact, from the Exxon Valdez. Neff says the data at this point is preliminary, that it's too early to draw significant conclusions. It is apparent, however, that oil can sink, and Neff says to date he has not seen concentrations that should cause biological damage.
So far, we have seen no serious damage to biological communities in the subtidal or deeper areas, more than, say, 20 or 30 feet deep. However, we haven't done enough studies yet to really make sure that that's, in fact, the case everywhere.
Dr. Jerry Neff, who's studying underwater sediments for Exxon, the State Department of Environmental Conservation is conducting similar studies, but they're not releasing any information on them at this time. I'm Steve Will.
Attorney General Douglas Bailey had set a noon deadline for Exxon to respond to his request for an immediate investigation into the erased computer tapes. Governor Cooper's press secretary, David Ramser, says Exxon's lead Alaska attorney, Douglas Serdaily, agreed to cooperate 1 hour before the deadline. Lawyers for Exxon and the state spent Thursday afternoon negotiating details of the arrangement. Ramser says Exxon will provide affidavits from some of its employees next week. The Department of Law will review the affidavits and begin taking statements under oath from some Exxon workers later this month. Meanwhile, Exxon's Associate General Counsel, E.D. Ackerman, in a letter to Bailey, declared that all primary documents relating to the oil spill are intact. The letter said the computer tapes were the backup information system, but that all relevant documents on the erased tapes exist in hard copy or on other computer disks. The letter said, quote, "I can assure you of Exxon's continued cooperation in assisting your office to fully understand the circumstances and insignificance of the computer backup tape matter." Bailey said he wants to reconstruct the affair while memories are still fresh. He appears unwilling to take the oil company's word that none of its oil spill paperwork is missing. The destroyed documents included internal communications from the Exxon Shipping Company, owner of the Exxon Valdez, and Exxon USA. So far, well over 100 lawsuits have been filed against Exxon in the wake of the spill. The plaintiffs do not include the state of Alaska, but Bailey says he expects the state to file by the end of the summer. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
I know in those communities that are really adversely affected that we have no foreclosures at all, and the few that we did have are being used or purchased. We saw Exxon purchase about 60 of our mobile homes. That certainly helped. I think they're looking at perhaps buying some more, whether it's from us or somewhere else.
The Upper Cook Inlet Drift Fleet has now had five openings canceled because of the oil and has yet to do any fishing this season. Fish and game biologist Paul Roush said oil has been found as far north as Calgon Island, and the department had no choice but to cancel the openings. Roush says that the Upper Inlet Sockeye Run is still building, but the peak period, which usually occurs in mid-July, is getting closer each day. He said, unfortunately, the amount of oil in the inlet seems to be increasing, and there's a growing concern that the whole season may be wiped out.
Certainly, as this goes on and the oil situation gets no better and, in fact, seems to be getting somewhat worse, I think the concern for this fishery as a whole gets a little more intense. I would hate to make any kind of prediction because we're not used to dealing with this type of thing, but we'll continue to monitor it. If it's at all possible to get a harvest in, we'll do so. But I would have to say there's some doubt at this point as to just how we're going to get that done.
Theo Matthews, president of the United Cook Inlet Drift Association, said Exxon has agreed to issue a check for $10,000 to each drift permit holder in Upper Cook Inlet. Matthews said the payment is merely an assistance and will not prevent fishermen from filing future claims against the oil company. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher. The latest closures were announced yesterday. Test fishing earlier in the week revealed floating blobs of oil in the water as far north as Calgon Island, and the chances of any drift openings were slim at best. But the announcement that Eastside set netters would be restricted came as a surprise. The set netters had an opening on Monday, and there were no reports of any problems. However, fish and game biologist Jim Browning said oil washed up on a beach about 5 miles north of Clam Gulch yesterday, prompting the department to announce the set net closure for beaches south of Kasiloff. Any future openings will depend on what test fishing over the next week reveals, but biologists say the oil in the inlet seems to be getting worse instead of better. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
The article, which rehashed old and frequently anonymous and largely disproven allegations, reflects a bias and cynicism that's not often found in the journal.
Sleepy Bay on the north end of Latouche Island was hit heavily by the Valdez oil spill, so Exxon received a permit from ADF&G to excavate a pink salmon stream by backhoe in order to remove contamination, with the condition that the stream be restored to its original profile using clean gravel. Halfway through the project, however, according to field office coordinator Marilyn Sigmund, Fish and Game realized that Exxon didn't know where the clean gravel would come from, nor had Exxon completed surveys before excavation to use for reconstruction. Luckily, as a backup, Sigmund says Fish and Game had requested that the State Department of Environmental Conservation also survey the stream banks, which DEC did, so a record of the original stream contours is available for reconstruction. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Thursday's front-page story in the Wall Street Journal, entitled Broken Promises, recounted Alyeska's history of battling safety and environmental regulation and the air and water pollution that resulted even before the Exxon Valdez oil spill. The story also detailed some of the shortcomings of Alyeska's critical initial response to the spill. Many of the incidents in the article have already appeared in the Alaska media, and the journal's compilation is now attracting attention in Congress. Congressman George Miller brought his House Interior Subcommittee to Valdez shortly after the spill, and his committee aide Jeffrey Petrick says the article confirms much of what they found there. He says Miller intends to hold further hearings and in Petrick's words, examine the Alyeska system from top to bottom. Miller is also having legislation drafted, which will include new controls on Alyeska and the oil industry. Petrick says three recent smaller spills on the East Coast have spread the tension across the entire country. He adds that in Miller's view, before new drilling can be permitted in sensitive areas such as the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the entire Alaskan oil transportation system must be proven to be environmentally safe and sound. Alyeska disputed the journal story, calling the allegations old, frequently anonymous, and largely disproven. Petrick says in addition to pursuing new legislation, Miller will be pushing the Secretary of the Interior to take a much more aggressive stance with Alyeska. Although Interior has avoided confrontations with the company in the past, the Secretary can wield tremendous influence over the consortium if he chooses, including the power to revoke the pipeline's right-of-way to cross federal lands. Patrick expects the new hearings to begin before the August recess. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
About 200 Eastside Setnetters are affected by the closure, which comes just as the sockeye run is beginning to gear up. The rest of the fishermen north of Kosilof are also getting worried about being shut down. Exxon this week offered an upfront payment of $10,000 to Upper Inlet Drift gillnet fishermen who have not yet been able to fish this year because of five consecutive closures due to oil. The money is being offered only to assist fishermen and supposedly will not prevent them from filing future claims against Exxon. Tim Keener, president of the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association, says their attorneys have been talking with Exxon about some upfront money for the set netters, and he doesn't like what he's hearing.
What our attorney came up with was that they're looking like they want 2 weeks of closures before they're talking about giving you advance money. You know, that's way too long. I mean, you know, fishermen are suffering some great losses here, and Exxon needs to take a better look at this and do what's fair. And they're offering $10,000, which really is kind of a pittance. I mean, when you're looking at the losses overall for the season.
Keener says if the Eastside set netters on the southern end don't fish for 2 weeks, they've lost their whole season. He also says it takes more than $10,000 to get ready to go out and fish.
Fishermen here, we've got, you know, four or five trucks and skiffs. You know, we're buying mass quantities of gear to start the season. And, you know, there's a lot of fishermen that put out way more than $10,000 just to get geared up for the season.
Keener says $25,000 up front would be more in line with their needs. The next scheduled set net opening is Monday. At this point, the Eastside set netters don't know if they'll be fishing or not. Keener says that just adds more to their frustrations.
Monday's opening is still all in the air. We don't know who's going to fish or where. And I think that's how it's going to be all summer long. A fisherman is not going to know when or where he's going to be able to fish. And, you know, you're talking a lot of mental stress also. I mean, everybody's just really at a loss. There's no way you can plan anything, hardly. And the entry pattern of the fish are going to change. The way they're caught is going to change. You know, you're redistributing fish among different gear types, and you're allocating fish along different beaches. Obviously, if the guys down below don't fish, you know, we're probably going to stand to catch more fish up here up north, and there's just all kinds of factors.
Keener says fishing representatives will meet with Exxon to try and work out a more amenable upfront agreement for the set netters. In the meantime, they'll be anxiously awaiting an announcement about Monday's opening. Reporting from Homer, I'm Laura Wilkie.
When the millions of gallons of crude oil spread across Prince William Sound, it took a path to the southwest that fed directly into the mouth of Sleepy Bay on the north end of Latouche Island. And crews are working diligently to clean up as much as possible before the fish arrive. Near the center of Sleepy Bay is an unnamed salmon stream that's receiving particular attention. Marilyn Sigman is the habitat biologist who works as field office coordinator for the ADF&G oil spill response team.
Banks of the stream were heavily oiled to a depth. Originally, we thought about a foot and a half down, although as they began work, we found out it was more to the depth of 4 feet in some places. And the oiled sediments were actually in contact with the stream channel because they were eroding down the banks.
Exxon's proposal was to excavate all contaminated sediments and to turn them over into the intertidal zone for the surf to wash. Sigmund says ADF&G thought that might be a good alternative, but noted on the permit that the stream banks must be restored to original contours with clean gravel.
We can't, in our jurisdiction, specify where that gravel would come from, other than not to take it from a stream. So we didn't know what their gravel source would be, and halfway through the project, we found that they didn't either. And so there were other discussions with other agencies, and we finally agreed that the probably best option in that area would be to go to the lower intertidal and remove a shallow layer far enough away from the stream that we wouldn't have erosion problems. And so they're going to use now this intertidal gravel and try to replace the stream bank.
Sigmund says the intertidal gravel is not the same type of gravel as was originally in place and will make rebuilding the stream all the more difficult. But Exxon's choice of replacement wasn't the only stumbling block the Sleepy Bay project ran into.
What you generally do in this situation is you can actually, using a surveyor's methods, you can survey out what the channel did look like. Unfortunately, they failed to do that, although that was required by the permit prior to excavating, but we also asked the Department of Environmental Conservation to also take the profile just so we had another record of them. So we do have a record of what the stream looked like before they removed the gravel.
According to Sigmund, there's a standard technology for restoring streams and moving materials, and that wasn't really adhered to.
A lot of streams were disturbed, like during construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and there was a lot of work done then to restore those channels and stabilize them. And mainly it's just having more and perhaps more specialized equipment that can have a little bit more control in terms of moving the gravel or in, for example, they used rubber-tired machines, which they thought would work better on not grind the oil into the sediments. But there's actually, I think, better traction if you use tracked vehicles. And the vehicles they used were fairly small because of moving them by barge from Valdez, and they probably could have done a quicker and perhaps more precise job if they had larger equipment or different types of equipment available to them. That's according to the people on the site who are construction-type people. I guess I feel that Exxon wasn't really equipped to do the type of job that would be needed, and we were caught with a real short time period, and I just am concerned that the equipment and also the expertise to do it wasn't there when it needed to be.
The Sleepy Bay pink salmon stream undergoing treatment has a channel 15 feet wide with steep banks that extend it to almost 30 feet, and Fish and Game says it's more productive than expected for its size. Sigmund says she can only hope that the stream will come back to that, but currently the crews are fighting a deadline. Work on the stream must stop on July 10th, and all crews need to be out of the Sleepy Bay area by the 15th, since the fish are due to arrive soon after that.
The big effort right now is to get off enough oil by the techniques they're using that they don't have this constant sheen coming off, which we're real concerned may affect the hatchery Samuel Bay around the corner. They have told me that they think they will have completed what they intend to do there this year by July 15th, which is before that fishery opens at Samuel Bay. We've seen a lot their technique applied in other areas, and we still have some sheen problems. So I think the technology they're using will get some of the sheen potential reduced, but we may still have some potential for sheen off that area because it was so heavily oiled.
She philosophizes that that's all that can be done with the situation, the technology available, the time left, and also the fact that there are a lot more oiled beaches in Prince William Sound that crews are trying to treat at least once this season. And she makes note that this is only one stream.
Overall, we don't have a lot of salmon streams in Prince William Sound that were oiled either in the stream itself or adjacent to the stream. The Sleepy Bay stream is probably one of the most severe cases of oiling like that. A lot of that was due to the booming efforts that were carried out by the fishermen early in the spill. They really did an excellent job of booming off the most sensitive fisheries and maintaining those booms. And then streams have some capacity to keep their own substrate clean, and in general, the substrate of the streams is clean. And we just have really a few streams that, because of the pattern of oiling, are oiled pretty heavily adjacent to the streams, like the banks, or we've now gotten some oily debris into the stream channel.
Are you reconstructing each of those streams?
No. For the large part, those streams just need some cleaning operations, treating operations on those banks or removal of oiled sediments, but not to the degree that we need heavy equipment in any of the streams.
Habitat biologist Marilyn Sigman, who works as the field office coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Guidelines for tapping the $1 million won't be ready till next month, but the five new positions in the Municipal Assistance Division will allow the Community and Regional Affairs Department to help oiled towns make their cases, especially, South Central Regional Office Manager John Sanders says, the villages.
The smaller communities will be our prime concern. They're the ones who don't have the staff on hand to, you know, put together proposals and to begin to measure the true impacts.
Spill expenses have unbalanced the economies and local budgets in numerous small communities now. The so-called oiled mayors went to the governor for help when Exxon refused to provide upfront funding for them to defray oil spill-related expenses. For APRN, I'm Steve Heimel.
Cleanup workers are taught what to look for in case Exxon archaeologists miss something in their attempt to survey every oil-stained beach. And in late June, crews found human remains on the north side of Knight Island. John Knorr, the commander of the Forest Service response team, reports that the remains were taken into custody by the state troopers for forensics tests because they were thought to be less than 10 years old, despite the fact that the site where they were found was an excellent example of a Chukach Native burial site. State troopers were not available for comment over the weekend, but Chuck Mobley, the archaeologist who works as director of the Cultural Resource Program for Exxon, says their analysis is still being done. Mobley says originally it was thought to be a forensic case, but subsequent trips to the site indicate it may be an archaeological case after all. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The actions were taken at the request of the so-called oiled mayors, who include people from unincorporated villages as well as larger towns. $1 million from the state's oil spill appropriation is being put into a grant program for spill expenses village and towns can't get from Exxon. Guidelines for the grant should be out next month. The governor also added five positions to the Community and Regional Affairs Department. Regional Manager Jim Sanders says they'll try to help communities make their cases.
And Exxon then can say, yes, this is something that we will fund, or no, we're not going to cover this cost. And if it's a yes, then, of course, the money goes from Exxon on to the community. If it's a no, then we begin to compile those requests that aren't funded and can look for alternative funding sources, or it could even be submitted to the legislature.
The Commissioner of Community and Regional Affairs, David Hoffman, was also added to the governor's oil spill mini-cabinet. For APRN, I'm Steve Heimel.
Attorneys for the state and an Exxon spokesperson agree that there was no breakdown in the talks over the weekend, simply a case of misdirected phone calls. Attorney General Douglas Bailey, reached at a convention of attorneys general in Missouri, said that the state, fearing the talks had collapsed, filed its petition with Judge Brian Shortell late Friday, just in case. As it turned out, the lawyers did get back in touch and spent much of Saturday, Sunday, and Monday trying to work out the terms of a state probe into the destruction of hundreds of Exxon documents that had been stored on computer tapes at Exxon's Houston offices. Governor Cooper's press secretary, David Ramser, said that Exxon had agreed to the list of employees the state wants to get statements from, but was trying to limit the scope of the questioning. Bailey said, one of our bottom lines is that we don't want them to pick the witnesses, and we don't want them picking the questions. That's simply not an inquiry. Exxon continues to insist the tapes were erased inadvertently, and that no significant documents have been irretrievably lost. From Houston, spokesperson Les Rogers said Exxon is, quote, confident that all Valdez-related documents have been preserved. But he admitted that nobody really knows exactly what was on those tapes. All oil spill documents must be preserved by court order. Whether the state ends up relying on its court petition to launch this investigation or not, the filing does include some intriguing allegations made by the Exxon computer technician who was fired shortly after the tape erasure was discovered. According to an affidavit filed by state investigator Raleigh Port, former Exxon employee Kenneth Davis said on April 24th, he received a memorandum from his supervisor, Randall Parrott, directing him not to recycle backup computer tapes because of the court order to save oil spill material. All Exxon Valdez material was to be stored in a separate room for later inspection. Then Davis says less than 2 weeks later, he got another memo from Parrott. This one directed him to resume recycling the tapes in sequence. That meant writing new information over the tapes, erasing what was already on them. Davis believes 100 to 250 documents were destroyed before workers realized oil spill information was being erased. Davis said some of those documents may exist elsewhere, as Exxon claims, but he believes some of the information may never be recovered. Two other items stand out in the affidavit. Davis told the state that at one point, some oil spill documents were mistakenly sent to a printer in his office. He said what he read was shocking, but he declined to say why, citing a disclosure agreement he had made with Exxon. And Davis says when he was fired, he handed in his electronic pass cards that give him access to restricted areas in the building. According to the affidavit, a former coworker told Davis that on June 9th, the day after he was fired, Davis's pass card was used to enter the room where the Valdez backup disks are stored. Davis said he doesn't know who would use his card to get into that room or why. The state's petition asked the court to order Exxon to turn over its documents by Wednesday. Bailey said if the negotiations with Exxon don't conclude soon, the state may be glad it filed as early as it did. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
John Knorr, commander of the Forest Service response team, says that late in June, human remains were found in what appeared to be a Chugach Eskimo burial site on the north side of Knight Island.
It has some characteristics of a burial site. In fact, there are some things there that lend quite a bit of support to that. Burial sites in Prince William Sound have certain physiographic characteristics, and this appears to be just an excellent example of that.
Knight Island is part of the Chugach National Forest, and the Forest Service is concerned with protection of all the resources within it, including cultural. Knorr says that due to the shifting of lands over geological time because of earthquakes, the two previous archaeological excavations in Prince William Sound literally found their evidence right on the tidelands. And since most of the beaches have never been surveyed by archaeologists, the Forest Service has been concerned that the oil removal process does not result in the loss of any cultural resources. To that end, Exxon employs about 20 top-notch archaeologists to survey soiled beaches before cleanup work begins. But there's a huge amount of area to cover, so cleanup crews are shown videos of basic things to watch out for. And if anything is found, work is stopped immediately for investigation by experts. The Knight Island site was one of those that had been missed by the archaeological survey crew, and Knorr says it's proof that the system is working well, that the crew recognized the area, work stopped, and the situation was reported. Also, he says that the removal of the remains was by an authorized person, so the Forest Service investigation is complete.
There were remains taken because there was an Alaska State Trooper involved, and the belief was, based on the information, that this may be a forensics case. And so the remains were removed and taken into custody for forensic analysis. And the results of those things, we don't know when they'll be back.
Knorr says he was told that the remains removed were believed to be relatively recent, perhaps less than 10 years old. Chuck Mobley, the archaeologist who works as director of the Cultural Resource Program for Exxon, says the facts are not yet complete. Mobley admits that just because you find bones doesn't necessarily mean they're old bones. There's the possibility of drowning victims and other circumstances that would result in human remains being found. But his investigation is continuing.
There was some confusion initially on here as to what was being dealt with, whether it was a forensic case or an archaeological case. And the state troopers were involved and investigated. And to determine which was which, that analysis is still being done.